Welcome to Bridging the Gap. We are Alaskans discussing issues that divide us in order to find solutions that will unite us. Today is the 30th in a series of panel discussions of Alaskans examining issues that divide us politically in these turbulent times. My name is Paul Thomas. I live in Trapper Creek. The objective of the panel discussion is to derive through questions posed to the participants an understanding of the causes that have resulted in the current polarization of American political discourse. Boy, we have that going on now. Subsequent to achieving satisfactory understanding of the causes, it is hoped that through further discussion, a strategy for positive interaction can be constructed, which can achieve a respectful accommodation of each side towards the other. Today we have with us back again Mark Masteller, Judy Donegan, and for the first time, Samantha Finkenbinder. The topic for today is the courts. And so the first question has to deal with one of my biggest pet peeves of the Trump administration. My biggest objection to the Trump administration is the implementation of the zero tolerance policy, which separated young immigrant children from their parents. Many cases puts the children in detention and deports the parents back to the country of origin. Due process is a fundamental concept explicitly stated numerous times in the Constitution. Trump doesn't want to hire any more immigration judges, so we are seeing more detention tents being erected. The question is, does the decision for less judges in favor of more tents constitute a violation of due process clauses of the 5th, 6th, 8th, and 14th Amendments? Go ahead, Mark. You didn't like that question from the get-go, so you give me the first one to answer.
I'm actually just going to pass. I mean, I don't agree with the administration's policy on it, but I don't know enough about all those different arenas to really comment.
You're talking about the amendments themselves?
Yeah.
Well, let's just talk about the judges then. Trump doesn't want to have more judges, and so because we don't have enough judges down there, then we have to keep these people, these kids, incarcerated in detention tents because – now, does that
– and it stands to reason for me that absolutely we need to have a system that accommodates what's going on. So we definitely need more judges. But I think it's part of a distraction policy by the Trump administration to keep people focused on something besides important stuff.
Well, I would say this is important stuff, but I think more than judges, what appalls me about it is you cannot have a 2-year-old representing himself in an immigration court. That is so laughable.
Actually, there was one that was less than a year old, like I think an 11-month-old.
Yeah, I mean, that's a travesty. It's a farce. And you know, it's at some point I was having sort of a little daydream about that it's so ridiculous that you'd almost wish that some judge would say, okay, whatever the child's name is has made a very good case to stay here, and I grant her asylum. It would be no more ridiculous for a judge to do that than to have a 2-year-old or less defending herself in immigration court. So I think the whole thing is a farce. And I think Mark is right that to some degree it is a distraction. I mean, I think it in itself is extremely important.
I would agree.
But it also distracts us from other things that are going on and also riles the base.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think, are there people in this country that think it's okay to have a 2-year-old representing herself in court? It's absurd.
So that's pretty much, in my mind, a violation of due process.
Well, because the due process clause applies to anyone on U.S. soil.
All persons is what
all persons
says, yes,
on U.S. Sure. soil. An immigrant is entitled to due process. So, it's so absurd, I don't even know how to talk about it.
Sam, what do you think about that?
Well, I think it's rather oxymoronic that the party of so-called family should be separating family, taking babies from parents who the only representatives those babies have are their parents. And you're saying, okay, well, it's the parent who committed the illegal act, so we must separate these children and detain them. Well, what's happening to this? Well, the party of supposed lower taxes is causing us to spend more money to house these children, give them medical care, give them food, keep them warm. And then are they looking for representatives for these children that are not their parents? And are we having to pay these people? I mean, that's just insanity, in my opinion. And as to the judges, why would we need fewer judges when asylum cases are backed up years backlogged right now? Mm-hmm. And that's one of the problems right now with immigration is asylum cases are just off the charts backed up.
Anything we want to add about immigration before I move on to the next topic?
Well, it's just, you know, it's to me, the whole situation is antithetical to what the U.S. is all about.
You know, especially anyway.
Separating families and then not being able to exactly know where some of the kids are. You know, we're not sure where the kids are once they get separated. It's horrible.
Yeah, there are many horrors of the Trump administration, but that is the most horrible, I think.
And you notice how we said that was a distraction, but then when people get too alarmed about that issue, then there's another distraction to distract from the distraction. But I think that, you know, you mentioned, are we paying for lawyers or who's representing these people? You really do not have a right to representation, appointed representation in a civil case. So that is part of the problem. And I think that who's representing these people are a lot of volunteer immigration lawyers.
Mm-hmm. ACLU and other organizations.
And, you know, that's very difficult for people because they need to make a living too. So.
Pro bono only goes so far.
And you mentioned immigration in general. Just on the way over here, I'm hearing about how we're going to send regular Army troops to the border. And we've already got National Guard troops there, but it's an expense and it's not necessary and it's a distraction. You know, because they want to have that happen before the election.
Well, it's also a violation because people have a right to seek asylum.
That's right.
And so if you say you're going to have 5,000 soldiers stopping a caravan of what, you know, it would probably be down to at most 3,000 people. I could get a soldier per person in the caravan. And it becomes absurd. But And it's so that also is a violation of
U.S. law and international law.
As long
as you enter at a legal port of entry, you can qualify for application for asylum.
Right. And not only that, as Mark said, that is just not who we're supposed to be.
And
as I understand it, the Trump administration wants to change the rules of asylum. They want to change the rules. I mean, they want to say that domestic violence is not something that you should be seeking asylum for. If I'm not correct, please correct me.
No, you are.
and I just find that so clearly you need asylum if you're being abused in your homeland. You know, and there's a country that can offer you safety.
Or if you're being murdered.
Right.
Another good reason to flee to the north.
It's quite a good reason.
Yeah.
What I just read before I came here is that now Trump wants to change the 14th Amendment, which says any person born or naturalized in the United States is a citizen. That's an amendment to the Constitution.
Yeah, you can't write an executive order overturning an amendment to the Constitution.
So he's going to overturn that by executive order, which, if you think about it, if that were allowed to happen, then the next president who might not like that could turn it back. I mean, that is not the kind of chaos we need. And plus it's just wrong.
Right. Well, he took an oath to defend the Constitution. That's, you know, so he's in violation of that oath if he thinks he can go ahead and amend it with the executive order.
Paul Ryan just spoke up this morning and did say that you cannot change that amendment with an executive with an executive order. So
Paul Ryan speaks up with great courage for a change.
Great courage while they're all pandering to the base. Yeah.
NPR has been reporting over the past few years about most localities that snare poor people into court, finding convictions for misdemeanors and imposing fines that the guilty party does not pay in a timely manner, which results in not only late fees, but also additional charges, more convictions, more fines, piling up debts for court costs that are literally and figuratively insurmountable for these poor people. They are caught in a vortex of increasing legal red ink that only a miraculous financial windfall could fix. Should we wait for that windfall miracle or consider other options to this court debt these poor people find themselves in? Is there ways in which we can make this thing better?
Well, I'm not sure courts are courts could stop imposing those debts. And that affects people particularly, I think, in landlord-tenant disputes where in order to contest your eviction, you go to court, and then you get court costs, and then you don't have money for, you know, it's a snowballing effect.
And it's also traffic fines, you know,
right.
Parking tickets actually can get this thing started.
Right.
So can we do anything different? What would you suggest, Judy, that we do different?
Wow, that's a big question. I guess legislatures could change the law. And if it's a municipal violation, city ordinances can change it, particularly traffic fines. Landlord-tenant's usually a matter of state law, but laws could be changed to prohibit that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And also, you know, we've gotten away from most places, I hope, jailing people for failure to pay fines. So. That used to be a practice. And, of course, now nobody wants our jails crowded because that costs too much money. And it's not so much a human issue as a money issue in that front. But laws could be changed to prohibit that sort of thing. But it would take someone who found that to be a compelling issue.
When nobody cares? Is that what you're saying?
Well, pretty much.
But I think your point about snowballing means people are being jailed because the snowball happens, and then the fines or the let's just say the penalties build up, and then at some point they say you are going to go to jail for these things.
Yeah, 30 days in county. Yeah. What happens? Yeah. You lose your job, and you have even less ability to pay.
Exactly.
Or what happens is you've lost your driver's license. You can't contest it, but you need to drive to the suburbs for a job, and so then. Everything snowballs when you're in that economic situation, I think.
Yeah.
It doesn't take much to
get... So we're going to have the system rigged then against poor people that end up getting just caught just early on with the inability to pay, and there we go. Sam, you and I had a phone conversation one time about this particular issue.
About... fines and
well, about the expense of the courts and how difficult it is. Yeah, you want to share with us?
I don't mind at all. It's a little different than say parking fines and everything else that can come out of that. In my case, my husband was severely injured, and the man who did this was clearly guilty. The man who did this to my husband, and the DA in Anchorage took the case in late 2014 and was very clear to me and my family that this was an easy case. This was an easy win, and all we had to do was wait for some reports from the NTSB and FAA. And 2.5 years later, I get a phone call from that same DA who had said, we're getting there, we're getting there. And he said, we're just going to drop this case. And I said, what are you talking about? You've kept us on the hook all this whole time saying this is a win, this is an easy win. He actually dropped it the day the NTSB report came out and more or less in bold letters said, yes, this man did this to my husband. And yes, he is very plainly guilty of having done this thing. He buzzed my husband. He low-flighted and buzzed my husband and struck my husband in the head. And my husband is in a minimally conscious state, and I take care of him at home. So this is now going on 5 years. Well, at the time, it was two and a half years into the injury, and I get the call from the DA saying, no, we're going to drop it. I had just freshly read the final NTSB report. The phone's ringing. I pick it up. We're dropping the case, and I'm flabbergasted. How could you drop such an obvious case? Well, come to find out, push to come to shove, there's a DA, particularly a state, you know, a DA, a state prosecutor, they do not like to take cases that are going to cost the state money if they don't know for certain that it's a gimme. They want to know for certain that they're going to win this case. The problem in our case was the law is written in such a way that, and this is crazy to me because we're a state full of private pilots, but the law is written in such a way that buzzing is not specifically spelled out under reckless endangerment and negligence, unfortunately. Number two, the state of Alaska is in the red, in case you guys didn't already know this. And it became very clear to me that the reason the state wasn't taking this case to fruition was the number of experts that they would need to call. This happened in an extremely rural part of Alaska on the Mulchatna River. And, you know, there were witnesses, but it required experts to explain this to a jury. And the state just wasn't willing to go there. As it was, within 6 months of that phone call, I spoke with the director of the criminal division and got the ball rolling and got a grand jury indictment. And we ended up doing a plea deal because, again, the state I agreed with the state of Alaska, but we could have gone to trial, but the push was to kind of
plea
not.
Deals way settle. Cheaper.
Way
than
cheaper.
Trials, yes.
Way cheaper. Mm-hmm. And yeah, absolutely. Money played a part in this, which is so unfortunate because as it is, the ruling, it was a criminal felony ruling, and he was guilty and he pled guilty. And actually, this has set a precedent. This is the only case in the nation where we have a criminal felony charge and indictment for
and
buzzing.
And guilty plea.
And guilty plea for buzzing and injuring a person on the ground, or in this case, in a boat. So, yeah, money played a factor, which is extremely horrible.
Is there a requirement for to prove intent? I mean, did he deliberately do that?
There isn't, and that's kind of what's missing in the law. It's funny you should bring that up. Reckless endangerment does not require necessarily intent to harm, but in this case, it was intent to buzz. He intended to buzz. He meant to buzz. It was purposeful. Did he mean to do harm? Of course not. He misjudged it. He should have never done it. First rule of flying is know where your people are on the ground and in the water. And unfortunately, could we prove intent? Yes, we could prove that he intended to buzz. But then it gets real murky. That's where it starts getting really just murky and odd.
So I guess you're saying a person could intend to buzz. I've never heard that term before, but I think I'm getting it. So you could intend to buzz, but intend to buzz to maybe frighten someone or not to harm them.
Right. That is... Okay. That's ultimately the goal of a lot of pilots. But, yeah, long story short, unfortunately, the state being in the red played a big part in this not going to what would have been a rather large trial, I think. Yeah.
That's interesting. Just on a side question you don't have to answer, did you have a civil case as well?
That is another interesting law, which I'm not sure if this should make it in, but that's fine. The man who buzzed my husband was my husband's coworker. This was on the job. And the company we worked for, a very large, very wealthy company, our own planes and our own pilots. And with that, there is a law, an Alaska state statute, that says you cannot sue civilly a coworker if they're paid by the same entity.
Huh.
If well, you're all paid by the same entity.
That's okay. Ridiculous.
It actually is a Republican
What about workers' comp?
Well,
we don't need to.
That's interesting.
Yeah, workers' comp does fall, which I think is very, very interesting that so many people are all for workers' comp now, and it's a heavily Democratic and liberal idea. It comes out of, was it Wisconsin or Minnesota? One of the Great Lakes
I think
states.
It was Wisconsin, actually.
Mm-hmm. Was it Wisconsin? Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, there are many decisions of the Supreme Court I didn't like. I didn't consider the court to be corrupted politically until 2000, when I watched on TV then-candidate George W. Bush declare that the Florida Supreme Court was wrong. And the Florida Supreme Court simply ordered a recount of the votes. Later, when the U.S. Supreme Court, by a 5-4 decision, ordered a cessation of the recount, with daily reports surfacing of voter suppression and other irregularities, I concluded right then that this court is no longer a legitimate interpreter of the Constitution, but a corrupt arm of partisan politics. That was my conclusion. Is my conclusion of November 2000 correct? And are there any other decisions you can cite which support or dispute my conclusion?
Well, I'll jump in first. To me, there's no doubt it's a political body because of so much interest between the parties of who gets to appoint somebody and that. So that right there tells me it's a very political situation. To answer your second question, to me, Citizens United of 2010 is the other case that's very important to me. That shows the political implications of the Supreme Court and harms all of us in the big picture. But
we don't need to get into that right now.
Yeah, but I totally agree that it's a political body, and I also think I don't know how to get away from it because look at how hard both sides both. You know, right and left fight to get a person on there. That tells me it's a political situation.
Mm-hmm. Judy?
Well, I think depending on the time in our history, the Supreme Court is more or less political. And I was thinking about that. Like the Bush v. Gore was a very unfortunate thing that happened. And I guess people defend it because we needed an answer. We couldn't go on. And Citizens United, I agree with you on that. But you can look back at times, like I've worked in the courts for a long time, not the Supreme Court. And I think that there have been times when the court has saved us from ourselves so that you have very bad things like Plessy v. Ferguson, you know, black people can't ride a bus, or Dred Scott, black people are not citizens. But then that gets corrected in Brown versus Board of Education.
But it took the Civil War to correct Dred Scott, though.
Well, it took the 14th Amendment, yes.
Which was
after the Civil War.
Right, right.
But the court does tend to do things that the political... In some eras of history, the court has tended to do things that political bodies are unable to do, like desegregate the schools.
Yeah, that's true. Absolutely.
And then there are other times when it does things that are very unfortunate. The one you mentioned and Citizens United and there are probably many other cases we could mention. But I think that what I have thought that at certain times, I'll get to the point here, I think.
Keep working.
That there are people on the court who are appointed. You don't get on the federal courts unless you're political. Once there, you're not supposed to be political, which is a little bit of a ridiculous thing. But that has been true for some people, like Justice Stevens, who appointed by a Republican, was a Republican and dissented vigorously in Citizens United. Powell did the same kind of thing. So once in a while, they rise above it. That's my only point, I think.
Well, I think the point that you're making about, you know, Republicans at one point appointing these judges who end up siding with on, we'll call it the Democratic side of an issue, is because back then there wasn't that kind of partisan politicking in, as far as the appointing the judges. I'm talking about since 2000. Well, basically since Reagan. I'm sorry, since Nixon, when Rehnquist was appointed by Nixon and then ultimately became the Chief Justice there over that Bush v. Gore. But what do you think, Sam? Partisan court or?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I just can't. I have to say it out loud because it's stuck in Dangling Chads. Remember Dangling Chads?
That was part of
Florida. It's just every single time I hear about Florida and Gore and Bush, it's Dangling Chads. Yeah, absolutely it's partisan, but it does go way back. It's nothing new. It's the only Supreme Court judge who's ever been impeached was Samuel Chase in 1804. And he was pushed towards impeachment by Thomas Jefferson, who claimed that he was too partisan.
Hmm.
And he was impeached on 8 articles of impeachment by the House and acquitted in the Senate. I believe that happened in 1805. He actually only lived another 5 to 6 years, but served out the rest of his life.
Yeah, but nobody was actually booted out. He was just impeached by the House.
He was impeached in the House.
Failed to convict
by
the Senate.
Right. Yeah.
This is Bridging the Gap on KVRF, Radio Free Palmer. We have Mark Masteller, Judy Donegan, and Sam Finkenbinder, who is with us today to talk about the courts. Okay, we're going to get into something recent. Go ahead.
Let me just jump in real quick, because I almost hate to say this, but there, to me, that's only one good reason that it's a lifetime appointment, is that you can see, as Judy pointed out, you can see people evolve or, you know, maybe not go the way that they had earlier. And that is an advantage of being a lifetime appointment, in that you're secure. You can now rule the way you think is the right way to rule.
Even though
for me, I would just as soon get rid of the lifetime appointment, and I know that most countries have.
Yeah, I think that's the idea behind the lifetime appointment.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, what we've really lost in general, I think, lately, is this feeling that people in those positions of power are supposed to be doing what is, in their view, and we don't all agree, what is good for the country.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
when you lose sight of that, then the lifetime appointment becomes almost a liability if you are appointing someone who will rule a certain way no matter what, which is what Trump has said he has done or was going to do. Then it's a liability. But if it allows people to exercise their conscience, do what they think is right in the face of great public pressure against that decision, then it turns, you know, it could be a good thing. But you have to, we've lost the essence in a way of what public officials are supposed to be.
And I think, go back to the presidential appointment. I mean, if you had a president who said, I want to draw from I want input from different groups, different entities about who a good justice would be, you wouldn't be drawing from just the Federalist Society, right? You'd be getting, but you know, we've gotten so partisan, and of course, Trump doesn't know any of this. He just is handed a list by somebody who actually knows something. But if you had a president who was really concerned about that judge being impartial, they would draw from many different sources before they made that type of decision.
Not just Yale Law School.
Exactly.
Or they might decide to try to appoint a person like Merrick Garland.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Who seemed to have support from both sides, but the Republicans refused to act because there was an election a year away? How crazy is that?
We've had 2 cases of candidates for the Supreme Court being accused of sexual misconduct. One of attempted rape of a 15-year-old girl. In both cases, the women accusing the men of misconduct were not believed by the United States Senate, who confirmed the nominee. With this being a fact we all acknowledge, is it reasonable to conclude that the lower courts also generally don't believe women who report allegations of sexual assault? And if so, what advice would you want to give to women in general? What do you think about the lower courts? Do you think they're following the U.S. Senate here?
Well, federal courts don't much deal with sexual assault, so that would be a state court matter. And I think that while a judge, and it also, if you had a rape trial, for instance, it would be a jury trial. So it's more a matter of whether the public is going to believe the accuser. And that's not to say that a judge can't have a good deal of influence on the way that trial goes, what the jury instructions are, what questions he allows of the witness. But I think I'm not sure that the courts are any worse than the general public about who's going to believe a sexual assault victim.
Because we saw the split of society down the middle of who was believed, Kavanaugh or Professor Ford.
Did you notice that when we talk now about Anita Hill, isn't there a general public perception that she was telling the truth?
I agree with that.
Yeah. Suddenly, like over the years, 1991 till now, suddenly Anita Hill is...
It's a great point.
You know, and so maybe in 25 years, Christine Ford will be believed too.
Oh, I think she was believed. I believe her.
No, but I mean in a general, just as the premise, Anita Hill is believed.
Right.
And yes, I think.
So give me a percentage. How many people do you think, percentage-wise, believe Anita Hill now at this point?
I'd say 85 to 90.
Okay, how about how many people believe Professor Ford at this point?
You know what I think? You said the senators did not believe her. I think they did believe her. They don't care. They want that nominee. And
and I would have cynically answered his question, both of his questions, with a statement that said, everybody but Trump's base. So, yeah. But I think a lot of those senators did believe her, and they just. But the system is set up, and they wanted that person there, no matter what that person's history. It's a shame. You can't tell me that you can't find a Yale or Harvard grad who has the same kind of background as Kavanaugh who doesn't have that in his past. Mm-hmm. You couldn't find somebody else that doesn't have that.
Well, and I'm not sure why we need a Harvard or Yale grad.
I was saying that cynically. No. Because all of them are Harvard or Yale grads.
They are now, yeah.
And ridiculous.
Well, I absolutely agree with Mark on that point. I fully do not understand when this started coming out about Kavanaugh. Why they continued with this nomination? I mean, surely there had to have been at least 100 other applicants who didn't have some sort of taint on their record.
The baggage he had was the torture of during the Bush administration, the opinions on Roe v. Wade that he vehemently denied when questioned by the committee, and then this whole thing about the drunken assaults.
But the first two are what the Federalist Society wanted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The other thing, well, but, you know, it's not whether you can find another candidate. Once they've put forth a candidate, winning is everything.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is unfortunate because I don't believe for a hot second that that man didn't perjure himself. I mean, pretend, and I obviously don't believe this, but do pretend for a minute that he did not force himself upon a girl. He was 17 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But let's pretend, I can't believe for a second that this person who beer drinking was such a big part of his time, his school career, that he never blacked out, not even once.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Granted, you can't prove that he didn't. So I suppose in that, no perjury was committed, but somehow it just doesn't ring true.
Well, I think if there would have been a fuller investigation, I think perjury could have been proved.
And for me, the demeanor, like I agreed with Lisa Murkowski, that the demeanor as he reacted to other senators was, you know, incomprehensible. And we sat there thinking, my wife and I sat there thinking, you know, there's these three or four senators that the spotlight was on, right? Everything was Susan Collins and Murkowski and the guy from Virginia.
Manchin.
Yeah, and I'm sitting there thinking to myself, why don't 48 other senators have any problem with the way Kavanaugh treated other senators during that hearing? It made no sense to me. But as Judy pointed out, they wanted that person there, and winning is what matters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If I may, on that last question, what would advice be for women in a rape?
Thanks for getting
or reporting
that.
Yes. Rape situations.
Yeah.
I think one thing that I see, and it infuriates me, is the stigma of having been raped. Yeah. Like it somehow is your fault, or you brought it on. And I'm not even saying that old trope of, oh, she dressed that way, so she asked for it. Not that. It's more of a, you are sullied now. How can you even speak of it, right? And it's so horrifying because I don't understand why the, you know, private areas of the body are any different from your head or your legs or your arm. You've been assaulted. You've been assaulted. You have been stolen from. Your privacy and your whatever.
Dignity.
Dignity, absolutely. And that should not be stigmatized. It shouldn't be something you're embarrassed to talk about.
And it seemed that to so many women, after Anita Hill and then after Christine Blasey Ford, they just were energized, but then they had to retreat. Because look at what happened to those two. And what's going to happen to me now?
We could get to why it's so important to win. And I think that is the maintenance of that sense of entitlement that Kavanaugh showed so clearly, and the sense of power over women. And as long as you do stigmatize the rape, you hang on to the entitlement.
Okay, Mike sent me a question here that I really know nothing about, but you guys do. Judge Corey of Anchorage, the judge about a recent case, accused of giving a pass. You guys know anything about that?
Oh, was this where the man touched himself? Or no, this wasn't rape involvement? Or
no, this was the one where the judge gave what some people think was a very light sentence to a man accused of harming a woman. Mm-hmm. Judy, you know more?
I don't remember details, yeah. And I know it was a very controversial sentence.
So the guy that was accused, he was found guilty, but given a very light slap on the wrist.
Yeah, and he essentially kidnapped this woman, and he got a very light sentence of time served and whatnot. And interestingly to me, you know, the Alaska Judicial Service, is that who rates judges? They looked at it and they looked at the situation and said, you know, within the realm of what we know, he still should retain a seat. And I thought that was interesting that they had done that.
Well, I think that's interesting. And, you know, I don't know enough about the case. I didn't even bother to look into it. But there was some indication that under the law as it was written, he was handcuffed a little bit in what he could do. And, of course, the sentence comes down very light. It looks very bad on TV news. And it's easy to say, okay, this guy should not be retained. And I might state a kind of unpopular opinion here, but unless you really know what's behind it and what the law is and what his options were, I think it's a little hard to say.
To make judgments.
To make that kind of judgment. And it happens all the time. I mean, especially judges doing criminal sentencing, which, by the way, leads, I think, to a very bad thing, so that you go through periods where you have judges, particularly state court judges, it seems to me, who do a lot of terrible street crime, you know, sentencing people to 185 years in prison just so the public will think this is a guy that's tough on crime and then we'll love him and we'll reelect him or we'll retain him, whatever the state does. It's a really hard thing to judge a judge accurately.
Because we don't know a lot of the details, the context by which the decisions are made. Did you know anything about this judge?
Not the judge directly, no. Mm-mm.
Okay, there's been a lot of disagreement about the status of the Equal Rights Amendment, which reads, quote, "The equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex." Sounds pretty reasonable to me, what that Equal Rights Amendment is saying. Is the ERA a perfect vehicle for the Me Too movement, and shouldn't we revise this as an issue given current circumstances? Seems like it fell apart back in the 70s. And
and why was it so difficult to get enough states to ratify it?
Yeah.
Phyllis Schlafly.
Yeah.
Right. That's the history behind it. You want to explain that to our listeners?
Well, I don't remember it very well, but she was something like Eagle Forum. She was a woman who strongly opposed the Equal Rights Amendment, as I recall, and somehow managed to rally women.
But I think it only fell a couple states short, and I'm not sure, to be honest, if there must have been a time frame. I believe there was
a time frame.
The decision is that there was a time frame set by Congress.
Okay.
But that time frame can be adjusted by Congress at any time if they want to go. And there was another state, I believe it was Nebraska, maybe not, or Illinois or Indiana. One other state that had ratified it again after the expiration, and they basically said, well, we're going to ratify it now because we don't care what the time frame is, because Congress is the one that made that artificial time frame. They can adjust it and leave it open. And there's only a few more states that need to ratify it to make it happen.
But it's amazing to me that it wasn't easily ratified.
Yeah, right.
Looking at the language.
Mark, I think I'm going to go ahead and get to this Citizens United thing just because I don't want to run out of time.
Because that's why I showed up today.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that I know that you were interested in sharing with us. So I'm going to let you get started on that. Tell us about Citizens United, what you think about it. I think it's the dark money you're going to be talking about.
Yeah, well, today, it's to me, it's the root of the dark money, but or one of the roots. So first I'll just read what the decision was. They call it a landmark case for three things: U.S. constitutional law, campaign finance, and corporate law. And basically in 2010, the Supreme Court on a 5-4 decision held that the free speech clause of the First Amendment to the Constitution prohibits the government from restricting independent expenditures for communications by nonprofit corporations, for-profit corporations, labor unions, and other associations. And I just wanted to add, in the majority opinion, the principal reason for allowing unlimited spending by corporations and unions is it would be done independently from candidates, and therefore it would not be corrupting. The idea now, of course, is that this allows large money to go to these independent entities that are supposedly not coordinating with a campaign, which to me is laughable on its face. But it's allowed huge, huge money to go into campaigns. And what that means is that people with lots of dollars have a much larger voice. And then I'll just follow up by one little thing I wanted to mention. A Pew Research Center report that said 77% of Americans support limits on the amount of money individuals and organizations can spend on political campaigns and issues. Same poll found that 74% say it's very important that major political donors not have more influence than others. And you mentioned dark money. So the whole thing is that
The anonymity of the donor is what I'm
questioning. That's what's allowed, is that now, because you're giving to an independent organization, if I'm George Soros, I can give to an independent organization as much money as I want.
And PACs can be considered one of those?
As long as they're not coordinating with the
particular campaign.
And I don't know the definition of a PAC, so I don't know exactly if it's a C4, C3, or whatever, so don't quote me on that. But I've got some numbers here. Hold on.
Well, I remember back whenever this thing started gaining some momentum, Stephen Colbert on his Colbert Report had a actually put together a PAC, had one of the lawyers that he put together a PAC for himself, just to show how easy it was and how ridiculous it
and
was.
I think it's the PACs that really started big time then. But during the 2016 election, 20 individual donors gave more than $500 million to political organizations. To me, that just says, I don't have that kind of money, so I know they're buying influence. I mean, it's clear. Everybody realizes that. And like I said, most of the Americans agree with that. But the Supreme Court found this way to say that that's okay.
It's almost as if in that majority opinion, which I figured we might get to today, so I looked at it. but it's as if Kennedy, who wrote it, was deliberately putting on blinders about what kind of influence this could have in our elections. And for instance, he says, independent expenditures do not lead to or create the appearance of quid pro quo corruption. In fact, there is only scant evidence that independent expenditures even ingratiate. Now,
scant evidence?
Yeah. I mean, how can you even say that? As you read the majority opinion, it's as if that he is being deliberately blind to what's going to happen, at which point Justice Stevens set him straight, but that didn't...
Yeah, but it didn't matter.
They were still 5-4.
Mm-hmm.
Any comment on this one?
All of this sort of thing just paves the road towards an oligarchy. Eventually, that's what it all leads to, is
which
the government.
I believe that Trump wants to become the latest oligarch. In June 2014, in the Burwell versus Hobby Lobby decision, the court ruled that for religious reasons, certain for-profit corporations could refuse to pay for contraceptive coverage of its female employees mandated by the Affordable Care Act, thus making their female employees pay out of pocket for any contraception they needed. Again, it was a 5-4 decision to make women pay more. Do these men have something against women? Do religious beliefs of employers have any business in the private decisions on how their female employees manage their families?
Well, honestly, the first thing that comes to mind is a little snarky, because I tend towards that. I wonder if...
permitted.
Is it permitted?
Snarkiness is permitted.
I wonder if these same companies would refuse to pay for a prostate exam. I don't have a prostate. I will never have a prostate. You can't get pregnant. You will never get pregnant. You know,
or with Viagra.
Or Viagra, right? Although apparently women can take it. I don't know much, but I've heard this thing. So I would ask that, you know, if it's good for the goose, is it good for the gander? And too, the ACA is a government entity. It's a government construction. And I thought somewhere in there was a separation of church and state that was just kind of something I always believed in. And
that's kind of like what I'm getting at here with this court decision, that Hobby Lobby can say, oh, we have religious objections to contraception, where contraception is purely a secular medical issue, as opposed to, like, I think you can maybe say abortion doesn't quite go there because you have an actual life that you can terminate. But contraception is a decision on how to manage families, right?
Yeah, and baking a wedding cake would be another example, I think. It gets very naughty, you know, and you're right about separation. We have really blurred that line, I think, separation of church and state. And, of course, Hobby Lobby is, while the ACA is a federal law. Hobby Lobby is a private company. So while a government institution probably would not, like I get my some health care through the government, they probably could not do that. Whereas a private company, that becomes not your. My question, you say, what about Viagra or a prostate exam? What are they going to do when a Muslim baker refuses to do something for a Christian family? All of these religious decisions tend to be upholding Christianity rather than other religions.
On this same issue, something that occurred 24 years earlier, I found this argument by Justice Scalia very interesting. In the 1990 Employment Division versus Smith decision, which states that a person may not defy neutral laws of general applicability even as an expression of religious belief, Justice Scalia wrote in his affirmation, to permit this would make most professed doctrines of religious belief superior to the law of the land, and in effect permit every citizen to become a law unto himself. Okay, I'm a Mormon. I want to have a whole bunch of teenage wives because my religion says so, but the secular law says that we can't have that. Okay, so would my religious belief trump that secular law? Obviously, in that case, they say no. But didn't he permit a corporation in the 2014 Hobby Lobby decision to become a law unto itself? Do you see any hypocrisy with those decisions separated by 24 years? Talking about Scalia here. Hmm. In 1990, he said we can't let religious beliefs trump secular law of general applicability, which I think contraception certainly applies to that. But 24 years later, he says Hobby Lobby can. Any hypocrisy there?
Yeah,
it's water wine.
Plenty. But, you know, I want to get back to something, you know, the to follow up on Citizens United, because now there is a movement for a 28th Amendment. And
to state what?
To basically say that corporations are not people. Mm-hmm. And there's even an Alaska version of that called We the People Alaska. And some of us have been trying to get candidates for every election to sign a pledge that says, I will support the idea that only living, breathing human people can be
Our people,
and that corporations are not people. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually, we've been, some of us across the state have been trying to get every candidate to sign a pledge about that. But that's an Alaska version, because you can do it on a statewide basis. You can do it on a municipal basis. I think 16 states have already said corporations aren't people. And
so over, you're saying they have in their constitutions, over 16 states have in their constitutions?
That's my understanding.
Okay.
And so you can do it on a statewide basis or a municipal basis. And some of us are trying to get that to happen on a statewide basis. But in the national level, it's the 28th Amendment that basically says we the people are, you know, the only people who are people are living, breathing human beings. And if you think about that, that's kind of the root of a lot of these different problems. If a corporation, which has no, you know, tie to anything but shareholders, if they can be a, if they can have the same rights as you and I, they have a lot more power than you and I do.
And they get double rights because each shareholder has a voice himself.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. Then there's the problem of what shareholder decides what the view of the corporation is and does what the corporation espouses comport with what all shareholders believe. Stevens points out in the dissent that, well, there is this legal fiction in the federal rules that a corporation is a person that can be sued and be sued. And we don't want to lose that.
All right.
We want to be able to sue General Motors. But he points out that even if you accepted the fiction that a corporation is a person and And he says, no, they're not. But even if you accepted that, there are a lot of people whose voices are, regulated. Students can't say everything they want. Prisoners can't say everything they want. Federal employees cannot participate in partisan politics. So there are restrictions on the speech of actual people. So there's no particular reason why there shouldn't be restrictions, even if you consider a corporation a person, which, as you say, is ridiculous.
Yeah.
All right. We are literally 1 week from the midterm election. In 2013, by a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court struck down provisions of a 1965 Voting Rights Act, which prevented certain states from changing voting processes without federal approval. Chief Justice Roberts' argument was simply that since racism no longer exists, we don't need restrictions on these states. Since then, numerous legislative acts affecting voting procedures have become law. 1,000 polling places have been closed over the across the nation. This midterm election has seen voter suppression floodgates open up in states like Kansas, Georgia. In North Dakota, the Supreme Court just ruled that residents who live on reservations that don't have addresses need an ID with their street address on. If laws protecting voter rights can be struck down by the Supreme Court, do we need another constitutional amendment to fix this problem of voter suppression, or is there another remedy that we can come up with? We have about 30 seconds. What do you think, Mark?
I'd have to know more to say whether there needs to be an amendment, but I think it's another point that says we have this institutional problem, institutional racism, institutional power, et cetera, that has been, you know, that's been with us for a long, long time, and it's going to be hard to get past that.
Judy, what's the remedy?
Well, it could be remedied through the courts. What's the remedy when you can have a Georgia governor, candidate for governor, being the person that's going to supervise the elections?
Or Kansas as well. It's happening in Kansas, too.
In Dodge City, Kansas, there's one polling place outside of town. So laws can change that, but then you need the political will to do it. If you would also need political will for a constitutional amendment. I think we're in trouble here.
Sam, any remedy?
I don't have a remedy. It's so convoluted at this point with the redistricting that's been going on, the gerrymandering that's been going on, and now this. It's just rife.
Well, I want to thank everybody. Mark, Judy, Sam, I appreciate you coming by, and to all you listeners out there in Radio Land, thanks for listening. Bye. Thanks for listening to Bridging the Gap. We welcome diversified perspectives. If you are interested in becoming a panelist for a future show, send us an email to manager@radiofreepalmer.org.
This program is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of moderators and guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, the station, or its underwriters.